Hello and welcome. I am so sorry I was having trouble with Skype tonight. This is Jill Ajizi. Welcome to Family Matters. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there. How are you? Oh, I'm glad you got it figured out, huh?
Oh, I am. I was having such trouble. There's a horrible rainstorm here, and I think it's affecting some of the computers or Skype or, you know, whatever the technology is. But are you having rain in Chicago?
Yeah, but it's really nice.
Well, we're having a deluge. It's horrible here. So tomorrow you'll probably have what we have now. I am looking forward to our guest calling in, and she's probably been trying to do that, and I'm hopeful that she can get through as well. So we will talk just a minute until Jill Jones Soderman can get on the phone. How are you doing, Michelle?
I'm doing wonderful.
What's happening?
I'm working tomorrow night. I'm speaking to the Illinois Association of Family Therapists.
Oh, wow. And what's your topic?
Oh, I can't even imagine.
I will tell you what my topic is.
My topic is something I feel kind of strongly about. I think that a crucial piece in mental health therapy for people going through a divorce who have gone through a divorce is really understanding the divorce process. It's not just the heartbreak of, you know, losing somebody you love or breaking up a marriage, but it's what it feels like to be shamed in a deposition.
Right.
What it feels like to see your spouse in court for the first time after months and months. What it feels like to be called a bad parent. This so often amounts to some form of post-traumatic that people just don't get over. So it's one of my little side agendas to get mental health people to do a specific protocol, whether it's a six-month protocol, just for the people going through divorce to deal with these things, not just the typical therapy things. So I'm trying to educate them about what really happens in court.
So you're really developing an entire system for trying to change divorce culture, aren't you?
I'm trying, as are you.
Yeah, so, we're trying. We try every day.
I don't know, Jill. There's a lot of satisfactions. There's a lot of people. And every time I speak to, whether it's social workers, psychologists, mental health, this is a great group to speak to because they're just in it to help.
Yeah, they really are.
You know what I mean? So they're so it's very different than other people that I might speak to. Because they're just like, they're just hanging in there. They just want to know what to do.
They can't
learn enough.
Do you find them, Michelle, receptive, though? Because I find many mental health professionals that don't know what we're talking about, first of all. They know what the behavior is. They don't know the words. They really aren't interested in anything other than going in at 9 o'clock and leaving at 3 o'clock and going home to their regular life.
I'm talking about treaters. I'm not talking about evaluators.
Okay.
So maybe that's a different experience. Because the treaters, this particular Friday, I'm going to be talking to evaluators at the Illinois Institute of Psychoanalysis. I can't say, but people who are in there just to do therapy, I think do care. What I feel like.
And then you've got a big thing happening in January as well with doesn't your judges training start in January?
Yeah, it does. Well, that's the one that's kind of interest to our listeners because I'm going to be teaching to all the judges in the state of Illinois about parental alienation, visitation, interference, and shared parenting. And you can't. And what's going to be different about it is that I'm going to be bringing a lot of science to the party and a lot of science about what's happened to children and much more devastating results than we want to tell ourselves happen.
Well, and so, I think we have to say how sad it is that there are judges who don't know what really goes on, and you are one of the great judges in the state of Illinois and nationally that really knows the down and dirty truth about this.
Well, I don't know about, A, I don't know whether I'm one of the few, and B, I don't know, I do know that I think that the system has a certain misalignment, and what it really takes to heal is from a divorce, and to heal for your children to heal is eradicated from the system, but not intentionally. Really, it's not because people know better and choose not to do better in many cases. It's because it's like the world of divorce has been going on for 40 years, and it's like the emperor who went down the street, the emperor has new clothes. And yeah, everybody just had to keep bowing to the emperor because authority was always vested in the emperor, so you had to say everything was fine, everything was fine. Well, to say everything is fine in the system is like the emperor wears new clothes. Somebody's got to say, what are you talking about? The emperor doesn't have any clothes on, meaning people are not protected. But in my worldview, Jill, I think people have to do a lot more to protect themselves because if they offload it to authority and they think authority is going to be the difference, they're very disempowered. You've got to keep the control of your own case.
That's what we always say, Michelle. You can't walk in thinking that your be-all, end-all solution is in that courtroom. You have to be an advocate for yourself and for your children because if you don't, no one else is going to.
Yeah, I mean, you may get some people doing that, but to and don't forget, we're all kind of trained into this authority mentality. We're supposed to believe that people are doctors. Everybody knows all the specialists know better than we do. And therefore, they may know better on a lot of things. I may know the law better than some. I may have some experience. But that doesn't mean you wash your hands of your own responsibility to understand that the system's not going to rescue you. And you got to hash it out with your mate.
The blame-based system is a problem. I'm going to stop you there for just a second because Jill Jones Soderman has made it to us. Thank goodness. Hi, Jill.
I've been trying to get through and cutting me off.
I'm so sorry. We're having a little trouble tonight with this thing, so I hope we can all stay on for the entire hour without any
I have somebody calling from Italy, so I hope you can get through.
Want to introduce you, Jill. Jill Jones Soderman is with us tonight, and this has been an interesting show. A lot of people have been interested. In fact, I had someone contacting me at 4 o'clock today trying to call in, wanting to know what was going on and why the show was. And I said it is actually our good friend, Michelle Stephen Walker, who's listening now, and I see him on the phone. So we'll talk to him shortly. But Jill is a forensic advocate for clients in high-conflict divorce. She works for the client as a personal therapist, an expert in law, an expert witness. She does testimony, and she's a watchdog over the proceedings of the court. Wow. How important is that, Michelle?
Yeah, you're more gadfly than watchdog.
Yeah, really? A fly on the wall. Well, I think it's important to have people watching what's going on for a client because there are so many people who go into court, don't know what to expect, don't know what's going to happen next. And to have you, Jill, as an advocate there for them is a terrific thing. You also have a PhD in psychoanalysis and an MSHS in law. And I called Michelle earlier and I said, what's that mean? And she said, I'm not sure. Well, I talked to my brother, who's also a lawyer. He tells me it's a Master of Science of Health Services. Is that right?
Yes, it was the first program ever given by Touro University, and it's a forensic program, and I think it's probably one of the best masters I've ever taken. It's
great.
Fabulous.
Just to educate us really quickly, what exactly is the content?
The content is law and expert witness testimony. It deals with a series of public health issues and the laws associated with it, the jurisdictional issues, the factual and scientific expertise. It's an independent study program which has a defined syllabus, but you can go as broadly and deeply into it as you want to. It kind of starts from the beginning of law. I think it took me 4 years to get through the program. It was an online program, and I actually worked with the dean of the university. And each course was broken down into a public health issue. And the laws and the factual matters presenting in the cases were multiple.
Let's talk about this public health issue, because while we were waiting for you to hook you up, we were kind of talking about the global problems in the divorce system and why so many people do suffer. To
Terribly.
Me, this is a global health issue.
I've always defined it in terms of my websites. I talk about it as a public health crisis.
Talk more about that, if you would.
Well, first of all, the way the courts are situated in terms of a family court, there is no law. It's at the discretion of the judge. You're much safer in criminal court, as frightening as that seems, than going into family court, because you are totally at the discretion of the judge. So judges can make decisions and order actions on the part of prosecutors, police within the courtrooms, that are at their discretion and not based on law. That they're based on the personal view and prejudices of the judge. For example, I had a client who was arrested, jailed, and subsequently hospitalized as a result of quietly praying in the vestibule of the court, waiting for a permanency hearing on her child, who had been falsely abducted by ACS, Child Protective Services. She was taken by the police. She was taken she was holding hands with other women in the courtroom and quietly praying. She was taken to the bowels of the court, imprisoned, missed her meeting with the court. She just disappeared. Nobody knew where she was. They thought she had gone to the ladies' room. Nobody could find her. She was subsequently ordered by the judge to prison. She was held in prison for 48 hours before she had an arraignment. And once she had an arraignment, she was sent to a psychiatric hospital for a month's evaluation without any probable cause whatsoever. And she could not be released from the hospital without a court order of the judge. And the judge was faxing in directions about what kind of medication she wanted the patient on and what kind of diagnosis she wanted the doctors found. The case was appealed. We did win the case. She did settle with the city. However, her child was in foster care, and the foster care agency, Mercy First, had held the child from the time he was practically born. He was a few months old. He was 6 years old at the time, and they were looking to have him adopted out, and they were looking for a termination of his parental rights.
But which is the but how would you phrase the mental health crisis?
The mental health crisis was that there was no mental health crisis.
But I mean, you said it's a global mental health problem.
Because judges within family court, it's different in criminal court, because criminal court has to deal with federal rules of evidence. And there are rules, and there are there's an appeal process that can take place immediately. There are a number of different issues. You have to be confronted by your abuser. In family court, people can make statements. Your defendant versus your plaintiff can make statements without any factual background. People are taking reports about you are making statements about you as expert witness, which you have no right to view.
No, I understand the concept. It's such a good point. I understand the concept. I'm just wondering, is the health crisis because of the constitutional and the evidentiary violations?
No, the health crisis is created by the courts, just as the medication issues. And it becomes a money-making machine. You have foster care and child protective services, which are making, when I pulled the FOIA tax returns on Mercy First, one division of their foster care agency was making $556 million in 2004. And that's one division. And they had Warren and Warren was the law firm that represented 16 different foster care agencies. And 16 different foster care agencies were making hundreds of millions of dollars, which people don't realize come through Social Security. They go through HHSA, Health and Human Services, through Human Services. So the experience of the court itself and the discretion of the judge creates a mental health issue. I have a manuscript that has not yet been finished or published, but it's called When Madness is the Psyche's Only Nurse, and it's about
who's only nurse?
Is the psyche's only nurse, which is about parents who lose their children to foster care, to another parent, because of the discretion of a judge. And underlying that discretion in all too many circumstances is an absolutely criminal process.
Jill, I want to grab you for a second. I want to move you back over to the center because we've kind of veered off what our topic is, and you were talking just a moment ago about losing children. And many of our listeners, including myself, have lost children to parental alienation, and that's how you and I sort of came into contact with each other, because I saw a press release on something that you were doing. You're executive director of a couple of organizations, one called the Family Resolution Center, and the other is the Foundation for the Child Victims of
And then there's
the
another one which is called ICARE, which is International Child Abduction Research and Education, because the end of, the farthest extent of parental alienation is abducting the child to another part of the world, to either another part of the country.
Well, I think the farthest extent for parental alienation would be when a child commits suicide or is killed by a parent.
Yes.
Abduction to another country. Yeah, right. So, you've got some pretty interesting views on parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome, and I'd like to kind of get into that. We don't talk too much on this show about the man who coined the phrase parental alienation syndrome in 1985, which was Richard Gardner, Richard Gardner. So why don't we kind of start with that, and let's talk about your views on what you feel Richard did not contribute to the child psychiatric community, because I know there's many, people who feel the other way. So I'd like to hear your views on that.
Well, one of the problems is that you're starting with a really tortured theory. The fundamentals of the whole theory are extremely impaired. It's not only child alienation. It's because some children can't be alienated. Whatever a parent does, they refuse to be alienated from the parent. So it's the alienated child and the alienating parent. And there hasn't been a distinction between what qualities causes a child to be alienated and what qualities within the child and within the relationships between the alienator and the parent who's the child is alienated from, and what qualities there are within the alienator himself, because it ranges from a process of extreme psychopathology or psychopathy and criminal payoffs in the courts. I think all too much has to do with power and money and who has the connected attorney or the connected court evaluator and the guardian ad litem who work as a team to facilitate the process of removing the child. So that the child becomes scooped up in a process. So it's kind of a multi-phase process. You may have a child who is alienated or has become alienated or who appears alienated out of self-preservation because of physical abuse, because of sexual abuse, because of reward systems. I mean, because of their own psychopathology, because of a folie à deux process that goes on between a parent and child where there really is an emotional connection between them that becomes exacerbated. We have a child who is, in fact, the alienator and who wants to become closer to one parent as opposed to another. I mean, there's so many factors that have not been explored and tend not to be elucidated in court. In court, you have your 20-minute spiel. You have a short report from an evaluator. Nobody gets to really read the report or rebut it except another court evaluator. So it becomes a process of dueling experts, and the parent and the child get left out of the situation. So you really never know the truth of what's actually going on within a situation. When you've studied situations, I'm working with my caseload of people that I've dealt with, worked with, and often continue to work with, which is are 200 cases, and they are extremely varied in terms of the level of pathology, the level of connection, the level of just pure survival in cases, and even in cases where children are brutalized, are sexually, physically, emotionally brutalized, they refuse to be alienated from the other parent.
All right, let me interrupt you for a minute, I'll tell you why I really would like to focus on what your thoughts are about Dr. Gardner, and here's why. It's not whether or not he was right or wrong, but in the court system and among a number of judges, because he was discredited by some people, a lot of people don't even believe in parental alienation because he was discredited. So, you know, when Jill and I were talking when we were waiting for you to come on, we thought, you know what, this is a great opportunity to flush this out and see what is the difference between what Dr. Gardner said and what really goes on with parental alienation, so we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
We thought you
would be the one to be able to help us with that.
It's more like, you know, like pornography. You may not always be able to describe it, to define it, to state it, but you know it when you see it. It's a multi-axial diagnosis, and every case is different. I mean, the issue is with Gardner. I mean, he has a core, interesting idea, and and visualization, which he then, because of his own severe psychopathology, which dealt with the belief that children should have sex with their parents. And I, you know, it is beyond.
Wait. Let's just take this one at a time. He has written that children should have sex with their parents?
He has written. I don't know why people, you know, kind of like become blind when they read True and False Accusations of Sexual Abuse. He talks extensively about the fact that it is normal for children to have sex for fathers to have sex with their children.
Do you know where exactly he talks about?
Yes. Read True and False Accusations.
I think what he said, Jill, was this, that he was trying as a psychoanalyst to biologically explain how this develops in evolution. And I think exactly what he said was taken by his critics and misconstrued, and he was attacked and smeared and vilified, as many of the alienated parents are that have their children reject their affection. So
he's talking about that it is a normal process for fathers to have sex with their children. And Underwager, for example, talks about, and as in 1991, supports Gardner's theory of the normalcy of sex between parents and children, and that if mothers, in fact, and I quote this in the paper part one that I'm doing, and I quote it and I cite it very, very specifically, and it's going to be published as soon as I get finished with all the citations and so forth, and it will be out in the press, and it will be out in, as a press release. He was not a psychoanalyst. Yes, he was at Columbia. He was also at Columbia at the period of time that was written about and extensively known by people who worked there, like me, and who taught there, that residents were sleeping with their patients, and residents and various people were having affairs with very, very sick, borderline and schizophrenic patients. And the underlying issue, he was not a psychoanalyst. He was a psychiatrist and an MD. A psychoanalyst is somebody who has undergone their own extensive personal psychoanalysis. Personal psychoanalysis, controlled psychoanalysis, which means that when you treat patients, you have three patients, you treat them, and then you discuss your feelings, your transference and countertransference reactions to the patient. But the issue is very clear and very clearly specified, and it talks about fathers having sex with their children.
Okay, I'm going to bring on somebody right now that actually knew Richard Gardner. Stephen, are you there?
I am, actually, yeah.
Hi, Stephen. Do you have a comment on anything Jill's saying?
Well, I'm listening, and I'm very frustrated because, to be honest with you, I think most of it is absolutely silly. Richard Gardner was no more of a pedophile than the man in the moon.
I'm not saying he was a pedophile.
Reference that he made to with respect to parents having sex with children were taken from a social context of him explaining around the world in indigenous cultures how certain civilizations evolve. He didn't express a desire, nor did he think it was rational or real, for parents to have sex with their children. He came across at a period of time when between no-fault divorce and what was taking place in this country was causing a turbulence that was not yet to be seen, and he was a visionary. The fact that he could predict exactly what was going to take place in an adversarial process in the family court, which is what we have today, because parental alienation is real. It's been substantiated by a variety
absolutely.
Of
questions. Absolutely, I don't question that.
All this diversion from the issue is semantics. It's silly. I brought Richard Gardner to an Onstead Institute mental health research event, probably back in, I'm thinking it had to be 92 maybe. And he was at Mount Sinai Medical Center for a day. I got a chance to meet him. I got a chance to talk at length with him. I also got a chance to discuss with some radical feminists who were picketing him in the streets, one of whom who spit in my face, true story, about what he had to say. And I invited one of them inside, and she sat down at the end of the day and listened to what he had to say. And then you know what she told me? She said in sum and substance that all the nonsense they were preaching about Gardner was in fact nonsense. It was concocted because the radical feminists were in fact seriously concerned that he was going to undermine the adversarial process, which involved a custody chip and keeping the adversarial process in play. So I really don't want to even listen to anymore.
Can I get in between this for 1 minute? This is Michelle, and what I want to say is to Dr. Soderman, let's say my question is, why would it be important?
I spoke to Gardner, too, and I also met with Gardner.
Let me just finish the question.
Yeah.
Why would it be important to get this information back, and do you believe that whoever he was or wasn't, that parental alienation is a crisis?
Absolutely. That child alienation and parental alienation and the various and sundry multi-axial diagnoses connected with it, from severe psychological disorders to severe psychopathology or psychopathy, absolutely do exist, and that it's exacerbated by corruption in the courts. Yes,
so bringing up information about Dr. Gardner helps us, and you must believe that it does. So I'm just curious of, because I know that you have, you know, you're coming from a very strong place in your heart, or you wouldn't do all the work you're doing. How does this help us exactly?
I think it undercuts the theory, and it allows for the for an unhealthy ability of certain evaluators to be paid off.
What?
To be paid off, to be hired because they will take a position regardless of the realities or the issues brought up by a parent, mother or father, that there are unhealthy physical dynamics going on within the family.
What was the connection between Michelle's question, which was how does Gardner play into the way you're answering? I don't understand the connection.
I think it comes from an individual who promotes in his theories a concept of having of permission for having concept for a permission for having sex with children.
I think that obviously it was taken out of context, Jill. And I think if you look at the chronological the timeline of what Richard wrote and when the criticism came out, I mean, he was doing just fine. He was putting out books. His therapeutic board games are still used. I mean, that was a protocol that he developed, and it's still in use today. And he enjoyed the reputation and stature appropriate to a man of his achievements. And then he wrote about parental alienation syndrome and about sexual abuse allegations, and immediately his critics came out of the woodwork, and they were usually feminists who used, again, as I said earlier, the same tactics as do parents who demonize a parent or grandparent in an effort to poison their children. And
nobody,
I mean, nobody
should be demonized, and it should be a specific clinical review of the situation, but it caused a suppression of evidence. There wasn't the courts made a huge issue of anybody bringing up concerns about inappropriate physical interaction between a parent, male or female, with children.
You're saying the courts were suppressing it as a result of stuff that they had read from Dr. Gardner, and that the courts were sort of believing that this was okay and they didn't want to hear about it?
They felt, I don't want to speak for the court, but,
no, but
the
your
experience
opinion.
Was that if somebody made an allegation, that it was automatically a false allegation, and that therefore the allegation was suppressed.
I would completely disagree. I have a lot of years of experience in New York courts and courts around the country. I would completely disagree with that. If anything, they tried to suppress Gardner's position in the courtroom because, A, it made references that the court itself was partly responsible for the growing epidemic of parental alienation, and, B, because you mentioned Dr. Ralph Underwager earlier. Dr. Ralph Underwager was also a good friend of mine. I actually used the principles of implosion, he explained to me, to deprogram my daughter. And the only way that he and Gardner really disagreed, and this is where the court became critical of Gardner, was Gardner had a protocol that basically said if you reached a certain degree of alienation, the child should have a change in custody.
Right.
And that's where Gardner's resistance became most noticed in the New York court system, and New York has set a precedent around the country in a lot of ways.
Well, New York and New Jersey.
New Jersey. You know, and I can tell you from my personal experiences with Ralph Underwager, who was, I think, a very brilliant man as well, that his biggest gripe with Gardner was that if, in fact, you had an alienated child, that if you succumbed to that position and then put the child in some sort of a deprogramming protocol, that in some way it was reinforcing the notion that the targeted parent did something wrong. So Underwager explained, and I was my judge, I used it for my own daughter who had been alienated for 5-6 years of my life. He used the principles of implosion, which he had used in a test case, I believe it was a Massad case up in Quebec, where literally somebody had abducted 3 children, taken them out of the country, they were brainwashed, they got back here. The judge listened to Underwager, and the Underwager's protocol was simple. Take each child, put them in a rubber room with the parent, and that the neurons of the brain can only fire so long in anger and hostility based upon 2 sequences. One is reality-reinforced issues. The other is those that have been impregnated by false statements. And if they've been impregnated by false statements, the firing time is limited. Eventually, it's going to burn off, and you're going to have a different process. And, I use it my own daughter. It worked very well. Underwager believed in 99% of what Gardner put on the table.
Jill, there's a question from the chat room.
Let's see, there's the Journal of Pedophilia in Amsterdam, Holland, 1991, which visits the issue of parental alienation of sexual activity with children, and refers to the United States as being Victorian and repressed, and that the court system is repressive. I certainly agree with the principle of confrontation with the realities and with the with contact and experience and the And the confrontation of issues that are real. The child who is alienated, the statements are very superficial. They're very thin in terms of what they can bring up. Oh, you know, my father didn't give me candy. My mother didn't comb my hair. They really don't have their own reasons when they've been programmed in that way. It's a difference from Stockholm syndrome. It's a difference from from other kinds of alignments with parents. It's a difference when the child really doesn't like the other parent. I mean, there are many different axial parameters, and I don't think that you can take it across the board and say that. Now, what you know in terms of what you've experienced in terms of the clinical practice of these people is different from what I've read. I have spoken to Wagner, and I had had some dealings with him as I was initially reading his work. But my understanding from Gardner, was quite contrary to yours, and quite contrary in terms of reading pretty much everything that he's written, his articles, as well as his books. His practice, parental alienation and the alienated child, as described by Kelly, I clinically think has absolute validity. But I think the addition of corruption in the courts and the ability to pay off evaluators in terms of saying that one parent is an alienator and one isn't has given that's what's given the concept, not Gardner alone, the concept a very, very bad name.
Have you experienced this in your own life, that somebody has paid off evaluators in courts?
Yes.
So
yes.
You're speaking...
And I have written about them. Yes.
And written, but speaking a lot from your personal experience of what you imagined happened.
Now, that I know happened.
That you know? Okay. Well, fair enough.
I think only about my cases and cases that I have worked with over a very extended period of time.
So I just so that the people who are listening who should walk away with some clarity about your opinion. Steve, if you would be so kind as to talk a little bit about what your background, who you are, because you just, for us, you're just, we don't go into that because we know you and we know.
And then if you would talk
a little bit about your perception of what happened with Dr. Gardner, how it's tainted something that otherwise should not be tainted.
Well, I have 20.
Talk about yourself for a minute.
I'm sorry?
Talk about yourself for a minute.
Yeah. I have 26 years of my life dedicated to trying to assess and civilize the family court process. From New York to Washington to California, I kind of tasted quite a bit of it. And I came in contact with Gardner's original thesis in 1987. It was given to me by a social worker, a CPS investigator here in Suffolk County in New York. Gardner was making a lot of noise back then because he was a prominent psychiatrist, and he did make accusations at the time that basically nobody in the court system wanted to hear because he, from the very beginning, was labeling the court as a co-collaborator, a co-contributor with respect to the alienating of children. And I will agree with your other speaker in that corruption does play into the process because it is a winner-take-all system, and that's regardless pretty much of what state you're in, and it's hundreds of billions of dollars in equity that's moved around when divorce is allowed to run unchecked. And as long as you're allowed to have a custody chip in play where one parent is allowed to pit themselves in an adversarial proceeding against the other in a best interest test, you're going to have a whole lot of turmoil. And Without evidence, of course. Your other caller made some very valid points in the beginning of the conversation about the fact that criminal court, you have much more of your constitutional protections. You have due process. You've got the
That's
right
me.
To cross-examine. You have the right to have evidence. None of that exists in the family court civil proceeding.
Right.
It's based upon...
There's also no oversight.
I'm sorry?
There's no oversight.
Well, there's appellate process, but and I've been through. I've
yeah,
been through
I mean, it's probably 26 years
Supreme
old
Court,
by the time you get through.
Appellate process is costly. It's costly. It's time-consuming. And the average litigant, male or female, who doesn't get what they want the first time around, has very little opportunity to appeal. There are successful appeals. Some of the appeals we've had in New York have set precedent about alienation, as a matter of fact, going back as early as the early 90s. As a matter of fact, before Gardner even wrote anything about parental alienation, there's a case in New York called Entwistle versus Entwistle, which gets some national press now. And then 1978, when one of the higher appeals courts said that any parent that would denigrate any parent that would malign any parent that would attempt to alienate the affection of children to the detriment of the other parent was an unfit parent.
Now, in fact, the rules before Gardner were much more sane, that things were much more, much less divisive, that they were much more common sense.
Well, all Gardner did, though, was he simply drew a line and said, this is where it's going because we're allowing an adversarial proceeding to impact the welfare of our children. Gardner was a visionary in that sense. He was able to draw a line, and he made the statements with his professional credentials that said, this is what's happening. He challenged the court system. He was correct. Whether you want to debate little nuances of whether his 8 protocols should have been 13 or whether Kelly had the 9, that's all semantics.
No,
The issue really boils down to the fact that children are impressionable, and parental alienation, as I can attest, as I know Jill can attest, and I think there are probably hundreds of thousands, not millions of parents, male and female around the country, who have tasted the result, the callous difference of a court system that turns a blind eye, usually,
yeah,
to a parent. Excuse me?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
But you know something? Children have their own ideas. And,
well,
you know, there are children who are not impressible, that not impressed, that they hold. Cece has done superb evaluations and really scientific evaluations, not discrediting children in terms of their impressions, but
children
really elucidating.
Children need role models. They need to see unity. They need to see a sense of continuity. What they don't need to see is their equity being ripped apart. They don't need to see a system where they're taught, literally taught, that if I lie and if I do certain things and I get away with it, well, that's okay. And that's what the system is teaching. So, yeah, I would say that there is a small portion, a very small portion of children who are not impacted by it. But I think the majority, the vast majority, being vulnerable, and depending on the ages, I had 3 children who went through a 14-year divorce in New York State. They were 1.5, 2, and up to 5.5, 6 when it started. I saw the result. I can tell you firsthand from many of the parents I've talked around the country that the result is their children get emotionally scarred.
Terribly.
Terribly. Sorry?
Terribly. Apart from the ones who have killed themselves. Darnell, Ackerman,
correct,
Ackerman,
yeah,
talks about the case of the young man who went to Columbia and hung himself on his father's lawn in front of his father's house.
There are children who have taken their own lives. There are parents who have taken their own lives.
It is a horrendous, but the court system is absolutely part of this and has absolutely promulgated it because of the level of corruption and the amount of money that's involved.
It's the level of corruption, it's the amount of money, and it's the impact that radical feminist rhetoric, which is basically women are
you know, I don't know
children.
About radical feminism or radical fathers. I think when you start pitting men against women or children against
to be an objective therapist or evaluator, you have to recognize that there are certain radical extremes. And radical feminism, as feminism has successfully painted since 1988, when it lied to the federal Congress and said 1 in 4 women are raped in college, which is absolutely absurd. And the federal Congress passed the Violence Against Women's Act, which basically has portrayed women and children as victims as men as perpetrators. That's part of the baseline that exists today. And unfortunately, that has impacted the court system substantially.
Thank you. Thank you for being here so much. You've added so much to this, and I think we should tonight call this the Stephen Walker Show, for sure.
But the father's rights and the flow of money from father's rights has
nothing to do with father's rights are non-existent in this country. With all due respect, fathers have little rights in this country except to being a wallet and a paycheck.
Yeah,
there are no father's rights.
I don't agree with it at all.
Well,
reality is, I think there is a real backlash, which is understandable.
Yeah.
But the number of fathers who are able to improperly take children away from others based on false allegations.
Well, you see, you've just hit the nail on the head. If there was a civilized process where shared parenting was the baseline going in, you wouldn't have fathers or mothers playing with the system. Because quite frankly, even when a mother is successful, which is probably 80% of the times, in becoming a sole custodian, she also has literally thwarted her rights because she's allowed to
there aren't statistics. There aren't clear statistics because of the amount of corruption in the court.
Yeah, well,
there is an incredible amount of corruption
This has been a spicy show. We have wholesale corruption in the courts, pedophilia being endorsed, fathers having no rights. We're only short of Martians. It just goes to show you how controversial things still are. The one thing I will say is I believe that shared parenting would address a lot of this.
Right.
There wouldn't have to be a fighting.
The system of parenting, we had created an organization called FIT, which was outside of the court. It was helped by the fact that we could go to the court, that the court could oversee if they were the final penalty. If parents could not work it out between themselves, you know, then their last result was the court. But it was a confidential, ongoing, voluntary process where parents had the ability to choose therapists, change therapists, to change mediators, to work in a semi-private area with the blessings of the court. I mean, the court loved it in New Jersey and made it part of a court program and actually added to it. And it was enormously successful. It was extremely, extremely successful and protected many, many, many families.
I want to ask you, I have a question from the chat room. How are you able to identify these parental alienation dynamics for her cases going through this, for your cases going through this, with the mindset that you have about how parental alienation manifests itself in certain cases?
My mindset goes out the window with any case that I see. You start from ground zero in terms of evaluating the case. That every case has its own merits and its own issues, and even where alienation exists, you attempt to treat it in the course and in the process. You attempt to move the parent away, to exhibit the manners in which it's not in the best interests of the parent to be an alienator.
Well, I guess what I'm asking you, and I don't know if I got the answer I wanted, what I'm asking you is, because you feel the way you do about parental alienation, I am
always
open.
It's not the way I feel it. It's the way it is the material that I have seen, read, viewed, experienced. It's what I know. I mean, as in with anybody, when you know somebody on a personal basis, you get a different view of them. You see different sides of them. If you read their writing, if you read a piece of writing, you get a particular experience of them, good, bad, or indifferent.
So you go in with an open mind when the case presents to you, and you don't have a preconditioned notion about what you feel should happen in that case.
No, absolutely not. I have a precondition in terms of the process that's going to be gone through, in terms of how thorough and how careful and how cautious one is going to be in terms of evaluating and reevaluating and looking at each part of it. The object is not to be fooled. Which can be done.
But an alienator, that's their job. They're good at fooling people. That's what they excel in.
But when you see somebody for a long enough period of time, and I'm talking about over, for example, when you see somebody for 3 hours in a session, and when you see somebody for 3 hours in a session over X number of months or years. Also,
okay.
An alienator, they only have so much material. It's like a psychopath. They have X amount of material that they can cover. You know, they have their story. And once they are finished with their material, they start with jokes. You know, they have another level of material that they deal with, and then all of a sudden you start to get to what's really going on because it slips out. There's only so much that they can cover. So if you see people under a long period of time, under a kind of very relaxed, confidential, comfortable period, and there also has to be a level of chemistry between people, that it's not an adversarial process, that one goes in from the standpoint of whoever you're dealing with, that you're attempting to ameliorate the situation, that you know, I'm at heart, I'm a mediator and as well as a psychoanalyst.
So
and
give
my
me an example. If you're sitting with someone, for example, if you had someone that I know well who alienated children for 7 years, and you have this man in front of you, and you met with him many, many times, how would you then portray to the court when you had discerned whether or not he was an alienator? How would that whole process go? Kind of walk us through that.
First of all, I always deal with both people. I always deal with husbands, wives, children. I get each parent to give me a list of people to speak to with regard to their observations, to the collaterals observations. And I don't have a structured list of questions as to ask. I just ask people to tell me about their impressions. And one can often get people to talk about their experiences that then starts to elucidate what you're looking at and whether somebody is, in fact, physically, emotionally, sexually abusive. Because the person you're talking to doesn't know what you're looking for, and they don't really know what they're talking about in the first place. So you develop a picture. If you're talking to 15 people, for example, on both sides, this is not a short process. It's not a 20-minute, you know, one from column A, two from column B. I'm talking about a very intensive day in and day out, seeing a number of people, seeing the couple who are involved, seeing them separately, seeing the children, seeing collaterals, getting information from physicians, schools, whatever significant others are around. I mean, that's what I do go by a list. But it's not a 20-minute process of, you know, of asking a couple of questions and flippantly making a decision that somebody is an alienator.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time because it's time.
We're okay. We've got some time. So I want to take a quick question here if we can do that.
I actually have to go.
Okay, Michelle. Thank you.
I have to go, and I think that this really you know, for all of us that carry around all the turmoil about this, this show really exemplifies how far we still have to go in our research and in our understanding. So thank you so much, Dr. Soderman and Steve Walker. Wonderful to talk to you as always. Thanks, Jill. See you soon.
Thank you so much.
See you later, Michelle.
Bye.
We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to take a couple calls here, if that's okay with you, Jill. Hang on just a second. Area code 815, are you there? Area code 815.
Yes,
I
am.
Do you have a question?
Yes, this is Richard from Deloitte. I was wondering what the panel thought about the remedy to parental alienation, the one that was recommended in my case, and I'll just generically say that in my case, the judge, several judges ruled that there was an extreme, bizarrely extreme parental alienation campaign, alienating the father from me, from my children, perpetrated by the mother and her side of the family. The remedy that the counselor proposed was, because of the bizarreness and extremeness, that the there be a no-contact order for a particular time, custody to the father, which I got, no-contact order for the mother or that entire side of the family for a period of time, and then through counseling sessions between the children and the target parent, myself, what the counselor called reintroduction techniques, showing photographs of good family times through the years, et cetera, and so forth, rekindling that bond, rekindling the good times, because as you know, in parental alienation, typically one parent has set themselves up as being saint, and the other parent is portrayed as Satan. So what does the panel think about remedy and treatment as proposed by my counselor?
Jill, do you want to speak to that?
I wouldn't comment not knowing enough about the case of it or the situation. The only thing I can say is it must have been a terribly painful process on all sides.
Just generically, just take it for granted that the court ruled in a case where a court has ruled through examination, long trial, evidence, et cetera, all experts say that it was an extreme and bizarre parental alienation campaign.
I would hope that it worked well and it worked out well. I would never take anything for granted in terms of you know, what the court considered an expert situation and, you know, what their opinions are. You know, they're lawyers, they're not therapists, they're not physicians. I would only hope that it worked out well for you. I don't know enough about the situation as to whether I would have made the same recommendation, but I would just think it would have been a very traumatic and very, you know, difficult situation on all sides. And I would just hope that it worked out well for you.
Is there any situation in which you would recommend such a remedy?
Would you repeat the remedy, please? And what would the age of the children?
The remedy, the age of the children at the time of the order, et cetera, were basically 12, 14, and 15, give or take. And the remedy was no contact with the mother or that side of the family, those who had been found guilty of perpetrating and perpetuating extreme parental alienation, until such time there would be a rekindling of the bond with the father through reintroduction techniques, as my counselor called it. And techniques meaning show all the family photo albums of all the good vacations and the good times, etc.
And where were the children to live in that transition period when they were no longer having contact with the mother who was alienating and you were waiting for the transition to the dad? Where were the kids going to live?
With the father who has custody.
Wait a minute, I'm a little confused. The father was given custody after the trial determining alienation, or the father was
using the custodial parent? Because of the extreme and bizarre parental alienation campaign, father, myself, was given custody.
All right. So you just took children that were totally alienated, and they came with you willingly, or was there a whole...
They stayed with me, but with great resentment.
Okay. But they were still emotionally able to accept the fact that an authority had made a determination whether it was legitimately in their best interest or not. That's not the point. But they were legitimately emotionally able to accept that position, and then they moved in with you. And then you had some sort of therapeutic transition where the process was to reinvigorate or reunite the bond that had originally existed between you and them. Is that pretty much correct?
Are we back?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry, I missed that last part of that question. Could you repeat that?
You were given custody after a finding of fact that she was an alienator. The kids were emotionally still stable enough to accept that authority, and they moved in with you. And then there was supposed to be a period where, through photographs, et cetera, and some therapy, they were going to be reestablishing their bond with you. Is that correct?
And the incentive, or should you say, or maybe disincentive to cooperate is that you will eventually gain contact back with your mother and that side of the family.
Okay.
That's leverage.
That technique has been used in New York. It's been used in a variety of states where findings of fact, and we can get into all sorts of debates, but whether the findings were legitimate or not. But I know quite a few forensic evaluators in New York State and other states who do, they do their best in these kind of cases. Their money is a motivator. There's no question about that. That scenario you're describing is not unique to wherever your jurisdiction is. The question I would have for you is, did it work in your case?
Even though five judges in a row ruled extreme, bizarre parental alienation,
right,
they refused to accept that remedy. They did give me custody, but did not did not order that type of reintroduction therapy take place.
So you,
yeah, I think there are better ways of there are better ways of reintroducing things that would be less traumatic and
sure,
less, you know, tearing asunder of people's attachments, either pathological or not pathological. The only situation in which I can see removing a child from, you know, from a parent or, you know, from other caretaker is where the child had been physically, sexually, emotionally, severely abused. And then I would recommend a criminal process going on. But where, you know, where there were, you know, wrongful and, you know, fallacies in terms of you know, having a relationship or wanting to interfere with a relationship with one parent or another to just tear children away and to, you know, to terminate, you know, any kind of relationship at all, I would just see as an extraordinarily painful and just, you know, breaking somebody's spirit.
Richard, where are you with the children right now?
Oh, well, it dragged on so long that the last one just turned 18, is off to college, and I have no contact with them.
Okay. Well.
To me, the toxic environment that they were living in is even more insidious than, say, a broken arm, because a broken arm heals, but a broken spirit and those who have been taught and conditioned to hate, that lives on for a very long time and impacts their relationships for the rest of their life.
That's so true. Thank you, Richard, for calling tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. And to Richard's credit, I know him, and he's an Illinoisan. He has turned himself into an extremely great advocate for changing legislation here in Illinois and has really directed his energy toward that end and is doing a terrific job here in Illinois, so I'm very proud of him. Jill, I want to ask you one more question before we wrap up, and that is, what are your feelings about PAS, Parental Alienation Syndrome, in the DSM-5?
I think that grouping it as a parental alienation syndrome without a multiaxial diagnosis and making it not from the viewpoint of the alienated child as opposed to the alien, as in addition to the alienating parent or alienating significant other, again oversimplifies an extremely complex situation, that the degree of pathology, the degree of abuse, you know, what kinds of tactics, what has gone on in the somebody's mind to create such a division, to create such a separation. I have seen, I certainly embrace the concept of mind control. I mean, we know it's used by the army. We know that it's used in warfare to quote brainwash and to train people's feelings and their interpretations, but that it's a very complex process and needs to be evaluated and broken down into its specific parts. Yes, it exists, but how to diagnose it and treat it, and you can't treat something unless you've made an accurate diagnosis as to what you're looking at and the level of either characterological or psychopathology in the process of it, that it's not a simple explanation of it or a simple treatment of it.
It's certainly a controversial issue with many people weighing in with different opinions. And I know in the parental alienation arena, it's extremely important to some people like Dr. Bill Burnett to have it admitted into the DSM-5. There are some other people who feel that just concentrating on the diagnoses that already exist in the DSM-5 and using those diagnoses to diagnose people who are in that alienation process. But there's been a lot of hard work put into writing the submission for the DSM-5, and I don't think it's happening this year or maybe in 2012, but certainly a lot of people have their fingers crossed for that.
Well, I think it has to be introduced because it's so much part of the mental health culture at this point. It's part of the medical culture, is part of the mental health court process. It just needs not to be used improperly, as so many other diagnoses are used in a toxic manner and used against parents to separate them from their children for financial purposes. You know, whether it be placing them in foster care or placing them with very pathological parents.
Another question from the chat room along those lines is, do you feel that the research currently done in defining it is simplistic?
Yes, absolutely simplistic. I think it is, looks to make blanket statements about very complicated issues that range from the seriously psychotic parent to parents who are simply misinformed, who carry stereotypes and misinformation from their own families or from their own from their own personal experiences, so that there's a range of people that need to be discussed and need to be evaluated in their own terms, and every case really needs to be carefully reviewed on their own merits.
Mm-hmm.
And not on this blanket men versus women versus children, I think that's extremely destructive. And I think it's done very, very frequently in the courts in a very simplistic and destructive manner.
What is sad by today's standards, I have to think, I think you would agree, is that here we are in 2011, starting 2012 in a couple of weeks, and we're still having rhetorical conversations about the validity of Gardner as an individual, rather than put all that aside and focus on what the real agenda is, and that's the fact that parental alienation is real. You know, back in 1993,
parental alienation is absolutely real. It's
in 1993, we were successful in New York in getting the Rye Pediatric Psychiatric Hospital to become the first hospital in the nation to have a deprogramming protocol for alienated children. It ran for 2.5 years and couldn't get one judge in New York State to send a child there because there was a conscious attempt then, and there still is today, to keep it under the rug and make like it's not there. That's why some
but
of
they the, do, but judges do take children and send them to, you know, these quote therapeutic communities where judges are getting kickbacks for sending them to.
That's
to
a whole other issue.
Abusive.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And
the need to keep dysfunctional children in the system is $1 billion. It's hundreds of billions of dollars a year. There are quotas. There are states I'm not getting into right now. There's data we have that we've assessed in Washington that states actually have written into some of their budgets the quotas of children that must be put in foster care.
Right.
So that's part of the system, unfortunately. And as long as we allow an adversarial system to impact our family structure, and that's a civil issue. As long as that is allowed to maintain, unfortunately, the collateral damage is what we're talking about right now.
And which is why you're experiencing the level of crime, the emergence of the extreme level of pedophilia, of destruction of families, of medication of children, wholesale medication of children. I mean, medication used properly and appropriately is a marvelous, marvelous thing. When it's used inappropriately and just given by the handfuls, you know, at the direction of the pharmaceutical companies, not by, you know, properly prescribed experts, it's a disaster. I mean, you're creating the next, it was in the next 10 years, a level of children who are going to need liver and kidney transplants.
I think, unfortunately, we have a generation that's probably close to that already. The amount of Ritalin and Adderall being pumped mostly into boys is off the chart. And you've hit now you've taken a whole new direction now, because if we get into a conversation about how the pharmaceutical mandate is to systematically medicate children. My concern about seeing PAS and DSM would be that eventually they'll get it there, and they will, and rightfully so, and then they'll try to devise a pill to make
that's
it go
what
away.
That's also what I wrote about in part one of the article that's coming out. I'm trying to slog through it. It's such an incredibly complicated... I mean, I talk about the folie à deux syndrome in parental alienation. I talk about the psychotic alignments in parental alienations, not just, you know, the quote brainwashing somebody or Stockholm syndrome, for example, is not an uncommon syndrome in terms of.
Can I ask you a question,
yes.
Jill? Is it Jill?
Yes,
two Jills.
Jill.
Double
Jill. Yeah, two Jills. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
What are you? In the thumbnail, what do you see as being the best potential to alleviate the majority of what's taking place? Is there one potential you can see that from your experience and your opinion? What would that be?
I mean, I've treated when we developed FIT, I was the one who took on all of the cases that nobody else wanted to treat, which usually meant for free. Also, that they were, you know, a borderline diagnosis and very, very difficult, unpleasant people. They tend to still be my patients. I still tend to work with them, and it's like I've been in practice for almost 40 years at this point. And 10 years actively in the courts. And I will tell you in a very simplistic way, mediation.
Okay.
Immediate, very intensive, long-term mediation where the therapist is very much, I'll tell you from my own style, very much available to the client, both clients, and where the therapist isn't aligned with one parent or another. And
if I could, you envision a mediation with a therapist as the mediator? Why would you need a therapist as a mediator?
The mediator plays a therapeutic role, as opposed to having a therapist and a mediator and a guardian ad litem and a million different people, where you have one person. You may have another person who's a case manager, so that when somebody wants to complain about you, they have somebody else to go to.
So they don't feel confined.
Stephen, we got to wrap up, and I want to make sure that we get Jill's information out there. You are working on this new project, Jill, and can you talk about that just briefly, and then we'll get some contact information for you?
Sure. What I'm trying to do is to write about in as complicated a way as possible about parental alienation, from the most mild cases in which parents basically dislike each other to the more severe cases where there are physical and emotional abuse of children in order to align the child with the parent who wants control of the child, to the really bizarre cases where there really is a folie à deux, where the child or the parent are in love with each other, almost a Woody Allen situation, but instead of being a non-blood related couple, where a parent and child actually falls into a marital situation, because those are ones that I've treated, and I haven't ever seen anybody write about them. So I'm trying to empirically describe some of the realm of what we're talking about and how complicated the system is, as well as to then also write about what we did with FIT, with families in transition, and how we treated these families, and treated them very, very successfully. There was a tremendous success rate. And these people often need to be treated for life. They needed the presence of the mediator, therapist, whatever the person was, in their existence, within their realm of contact, really probably for the most of their lives.
I wish that you could, when in your writing, because you write very well. I've read some of the things that you've written, and I think I wish that you could, in writing this new paper, that you could somehow separate out parental alienation the way it happens to us. The way I know it, the way Stephen knows it, the way all of our listeners and people in the chat room know it, and separate that out, because it's enough. It's enough for a whole paper. It's enough for a whole study. It's enough. And to throw the folie à deux or any of the other things into it, make it look like it's a sidebar.
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give drafts to various people and have them critique it.
Great.
And write several different versions of it. But I think the critiquing is very, first of all, it's a learning experience for me in terms of writing about it. I haven't, in reviewing as much literature as I can possibly get my hands on, haven't seen it written in this way, but I've handed it out to a lot of people and gotten a lot of feedback. So I'd be glad to give you copies for comment and critique, and we'll certainly incorporate.
Terrific.
And do a specific study just on that. I mean, there's enough material to go around.
Yes, absolutely. You'll be working 24 hours a day for the next 30 years.
Oh, yeah. But
Stephen, you're asking me for Stephen's asking me for 30 seconds. All right, Stephen, go. 30 seconds.
I just want to sum up, pretty briefly that the real issue is to alleviate the fertile ground where alienation takes place, and that's to remove the potential for adversarial proceedings.
Yes.
That happens best in mediation. It happens best in a shared parenting environment. Okay.
Yes.
Every venue and jurisdiction that has a shared parenting environment has proven statistically, the data is clear, that the adversarial proceeding is substantially diminished. Children don't get damaged. The incentive for trying to alienate, for wanting to alienate,
right,
is taken out of the equation. So that
except
becomes,
if you have very pathological parents.
Well, those are the extremes, though. Those
right.
are the extremes in our society. For the most part, at least that's been my experience, those are the extremes. If the baseline is set up where we're not anticipating the extreme, and we're saying that two rational people that got together and had a couple of kids and now can't
absolutely.
Work it out, they're going to sit down and they're going to work it out now, period. They're not going to throw
right.
mud and rocks
on. And they can be incentivized to do that.
Exactly. That's the way it should work out.
Right.
And
terrific.
Without that as a protocol, we're going to continue to have the kind of...
And it's only 10% that are the extreme, are really the extreme psychopathological abusers. Do you want me to give
all right.
your
phone number? We have got about 60 seconds left, and Jill, I absolutely want you to get your contact information out there, so can you give us your website and your
I'm going to give you my phone number
okay.
and my website.
Okay.
My phone number is 845-649-5588. And the main website, which incorporates other websites, there are like 14 websites. The main website is familycourtintervention.com.
All right. Stephen, this was an unexpected pleasure having you on tonight. Thank you. You're always full of information. And you have been a guest in the past, and you were terrific. Jill, thank you so much for taking
an
extra half an hour with us.
You are the best moderator. You are... an
thank
incredible
you.
Moderator. I mean, you were
thank
able
you.
To get so much out of everybody.
Yep.
Well, good. I'm glad because I think we did have a terrific show tonight, and the chat room was full. And as Ruthie said, we blew the board wherever it is in Titusville, Florida. And so I'm glad that there was a lot of people listening to some really good information tonight. We had a spirited debate, and that's always great. And Jill, have a great night. We will be talking soon. And
wonderful,
on
and
project.
I will send the material to you to critique.
Terrific, I'll be looking for it.
Have
thanks
nice
so
night.
Much, Stephen. Have a great night.
You too. Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.